Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com, and with me, as always, is Hannah Bookdahl of chickflix.net. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, Charlie.
How are you today?
I am doing wonderful. How are you?
Outstanding, and I'm actually doing a little bit better in an emotionally, mentally state of being, because the movies this week, while still not that good, were so much better than the past 2 weeks.
They didn't suck.
They're not amazing, but oh man, it didn't hurt my soul.
Okay, good.
Going to the movie theater this week. And I wanted to open with one of this weekend's largest openings, Disney's The Finest Hours. Did you happen to see this one, Hannah?
I did.
Well, Disney, when they're not giving us Aladdin, The Lion King, and Frozen, love to give us based on true story live action films. And they're usually athletic in nature. Cool Runnings, Miracle, Invincible, last year's McFarland USA. But this one, while based
Rise
on
of the Titans.
Remember the Titans, one of the biggest ones. So they have a long track record of athletic true stories.
Secretariat.
This one is not athletic. I'm sure, I mean, they exert a lot of energy, but it's not a sport. It's the Coast Guard. It's based on a book, a true story of what the Coast Guard still claims is their most successful small boat rescue to date. 1952, New England, Massachusetts, just off of Cape Cod, huge nor'easter. Two 500-foot oil tankers are out in the Atlantic, just off of Massachusetts, and they are having a problem. They were shoddily built tankers during World War II. When they just had to mass produce this stuff off the line. And during this storm, two of them crack in half. The first one gets out a distress call. So all of Boston, all of Nantucket Coast Guard zooms on their way. A second one, the front half immediately sinks, taking all of the officers and leadership with it. So the men on the stern are somehow still just floating on half a ship. No distress call. No one's coming until various sequences happen. And then little old Chatham, Massachusetts Coast Guard station to the rescue, specifically Chris Pine. Chris Pine, playing a man named Bernie Weber, goes out in a small lifeguard craft not meant for this storm, not meant to carry as many people as they expected to carry should they find that ship. This is a man against the odds, a survival story. His counterpart is Casey Affleck. He is the man reluctantly in charge of somehow keeping half an oil tanker afloat and keeping the men from falling into just direct anarchy and killing each other. And Eric Bana shows up as a leader that we will discuss, I think, in a moment, issues with Eric Bana.
It's also a Disney movie. The
night before the big storm, of course, Bernie gets engaged to Miriam, played by Holiday Granger, and she is no pushover. She's no 50s housewife. She'll let you have it. She'll give you the what for. So a quick wrap up. The Finest Hours is okay.
It's okay.
You know, it's not amazing. It's not necessarily good, but it's not terrible. It's not The Fifth Wave. It's not Ride Along 2. Comparing it just to last year's McFarland USA, I actually like that better than this. Hannah, what is your take?
I put it, I agree, it's okay. It was a disappointment for what I expect from a Disney based on a true life story. They kind of missed the boat, so to speak, with the love story that's tangled in there, because they try to go back and forth between a romantic story about this pair getting together and getting engaged, and then the guy finally realizing that, yes, he's good to marry this woman, and then, of course, he goes out on what many consider to be a suicide mission. But then it bounces back and forth between what's happening with his fiancée on shore and what's happening out on the water with him. And they use these loud crescendos of music that are just way over the top every time they go out to the water. And then it's much quieter when they cut to the scenes inland. And it doesn't hold together very well for me. It's also for the Chris Pine fans out there who are expecting to see your rom-com Chris Pine or your Star Trek Chris Pine or maybe your Into the Woods, fun, really good-looking Chris Pine. He does not, this is not a role where he is meant to actually look his most attractive or seem his most savvy and smart and romantic. He comes off kind of dim through the first part of the movie to me, and I just didn't really feel enough for any of these characters, and that's unusual for this type of Disney movie.
You know, I think that feeling of he was dim, he's not showy, it was on purpose. The director, Craig Gillespie is his name, he did another Disney true story, Million Dollar Arm. He also did Lars and the Real Girl, if you remember that one.
Oh, I love Lars and the Real Girl.
But I think, I have a hunch that on purpose, he told both Chris Pine and Casey Affleck, look, you're not heroes. You're just two regular Joes in a tough situation. And so I want you to talk like it. So they don't, the most important lines you hear them say are actually kind of whispered. They're understated. They're not, action heroes would be yelling and waving their arms and look at me, I'm going to save you. Not these two. These two don't do that. And I applaud that because, just like you said, that music is powerful. It's overbearing. Oh. It hurts. And I don't think you know this. I'm going to blow your mind here. Yes. It's by Carter Burwell, who did Carol.
Oh, okay. Carol. Wow. Talk about two very different styles, although the same era.
Same year. Same year. Region. And I wanted to point out what is going on with filmmakers in 1952 Northeast America. Carol, Brooklyn, The Finest Hours. You know, branch out a little bit here, folks.
Oh, later we will. We'll branch out to Trumbo and talk about 1950s West.
Ooh, all the way to the West Coast.
All the way to Hollywood.
Three different time zones. But another issue, not necessarily a problem, but more of a standard issue, is it was in 3D.
Yes.
What a waste.
Total waste. There was absolutely nothing in what I saw that would justify spending that extra $3 for the 3D. If you're going to see it on a big screen, then 2D is fine.
2D is absolutely fine. Nothing jumped off the screen. The waves, the water, the Miriam, you know, nothing happened.
No.
Also, when I mentioned to a friend I'm going to see The Finest Hours, she said, what do we need another Dudes at Sea movie for? So it got me thinking, have we had a lot of Dudes at Sea movies lately? And I remembered,
yes.
Okay, we had one last month.
In the Heart of the Sea.
By Ron Howard, which nobody saw.
Right.
And a couple years ago, Captain Phillips popped into my mind, a much better film. But when you really sit down to look at it, there was also Black Sea, another Jude Law, no one saw it, and you know, just as forgettable as The Finest Hours will be. All Is Lost, Robert Redford. A Hijacking, nominated for Best Foreign Film 2 years ago. So there actually have been a lot of Dudes at Sea movies, and this one I think will be one of the very forgettable ones. You're not going to remember this one.
No, and I actually took note of the fact that I think it falls in the same categories in The Heart of the Sea, and that just with Chris Hemsworth, so you swap out Chris Hemsworth for Chris Pine, put another, you know, advance it a few years, and you're really seeing the same style of movie, and I don't think one was much better than the other. I think if you're gonna see a giant waves crashing against a big boat movie, then you can choose either In the Heart of the Sea or this one, The Finest Hours, and sort of feel like you've seen essentially the same thing.
I think both of them are actually just fine to skip.
Yeah, well, and that's true too. And that one too was based on a true story, the story that inspired Moby Dick.
Because when I think of Moby Dick, I think of truth. And the maybe another thing that's not so true in this movie is the Boston accents. Casey Affleck, fine. I think that's why a lot of people walk out saying, you know what, Casey Affleck was the best part of that film because he has a believable Boston accent. Not so Chris Pine. And a very interesting thing they did here with Eric Bana. He plays the station chief, a brand new station chief, kind of afraid, kind of still trying to prove his authority. And they made him a glaring Southerner. Now, Eric Bana is Australian. He has done accents before. He was in Munich, and he was believable, I guess, as an Israeli Jew hunting down people, assassin style. But here, his Southern drawl mixed in with this Boston brogue is really awful.
It's a little distracting, and all the accents were a bit distracting. I agree, though, that that Casey Affleck was probably, to me, the strongest role in this film. He was really entertaining to watch. I liked him. I was really shocked. Eric Bana had nothing to do in this movie. Yet he's got top billing up there ahead of Holiday Granger, who plays the girlfriend, and is not on the poster.
It's because nobody knows who Holiday Granger is.
I don't care.
She was in Anna Karenina, I guess.
But it doesn't matter, because she is way more important in this movie than the Eric Bana character. And if you went in there, if you're drawn in by Eric Bana, then it's false advertising, because he really does nothing other than sit in his office in the Coast Guard station on his radio or at his desk. And that's the extent of his role in this movie. So I think Holiday Granger should be a little annoyed by that.
Well, yeah, Eric Bana was just in a plug-and-play situation. Anyone could have just done what he did and barked orders and kind of gotten defensive, which is what he did. Yeah. Holiday Granger, actually, I think, has more lines than Chris Pine.
Yeah. Although I didn't really like her, and I didn't really like him, and that was my biggest problem overall with their story, is when they first meet, I really think that he's going to turn out that he's going to be fall for her friend that she was with for a double date.
He calls her a name.
Yeah.
But like, I am not that great with women, but when you first meet maybe your future wife and she's wearing a fur coat, don't call her Smokey the Bear. Don't do it.
And then she's the one who asks him to marry him, and he's reluctant. But the whole thing, that I didn't feel any chemistry between them. And so that made it very difficult for me to ultimately care about their happy ending there.
So final verdict, I say skip it.
I say if you're a huge Chris Pine fan or a Coast Guard rescue movie fan, like if you liked that one with Ashton Kutcher a while back.
Nobody saw that either.
I know. Nobody saw that. If you did see it and you liked it, then you might want to go see this one. But I would not hurry out to see it. That's for sure.
Fair enough. Now, interesting transition here. The next one we're going to talk about is also based on a true story. What are we about to hear, Hannah?
I did, in fact, watch Trumbo. You kind of dared me, I think, to watch that one. And I did have the screener, and it had been sitting there waiting for me to watch it. And I do like, again, it's based on a true story. I like those. And so I sat down and I watched Trumbo this week, which has been out for probably maybe a month or two now. It's not in wide release. It's not what would be a typical mainstream movie, but I did enjoy it. It is about these 10 Hollywood writers that were blacklisted during sort of that McCarthy era, where they were either members of the Communist Party or considered communist sympathizers. And the House Committee on Un-American Activities decided that these Hollywood writers should not be able to work, and that they were essentially prevented from working. They were called in front of this committee in Washington, and if they didn't give up names and declare themselves members of the Communist Party, then they would be sent to jail. And so this guy, Dalton Trumbo, who really was probably the top writer in Hollywood at the time, who was somebody who was a radical, but a communist sympathizer, but ultimately a pretty decent guy who really meant well for wanting to share the wealth with other people, he was willing to go to jail in order to protect what he considered to be his First Amendment rights and to not testify and answer questions in front of this ridiculous congressional panel. And then the movie really just is about his battle to still earn a living and to write movies and to get recognition for writing movies. He has to write under an assumed name or have somebody else sell his screenplays in order to make money. And one of those first screenplays actually wins an Oscar. And that is one of my favorite movies, Roman Holiday. And so I don't know if any, I would never have even known this story, that the guy who won the Oscar for Roman Holiday was not the one who actually wrote it, and that it was written by this guy, Dalton Trumbo. And Bryan Cranston, who's been nominated for an Oscar for Best Actor in this movie, is the best part of this movie. He's very good. I don't think all the supporting characters did that great, but it's a very interesting movie. I enjoyed it. It's very kind of good night and good luck kind of vibe going on.
I'm not sure I've ever seen a truly good movie about the Hollywood blacklist. It's an important subject. You have to learn about it, and this is one of the stronger stories about it. But it's not a great film. Dalton Trumbo was the highest paid screenwriter in the entire world when this went down. And he did not name names and became one of the Hollywood 10. And I think Bryan Cranston did just fine, but I think anyone would have done just fine in that role. This is a role that gets nominated for an Oscar. The actor doesn't get nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
The role of Dalton Trumbo got nominated for an Oscar. And the strongest, I think, part of the film is when he gets out of prison and he's starting to write under pseudonyms for really cheap money, but he gets all his friends to do it too. So actually, most of the films it shows that come out in the 50s were written by blacklisted writers under assumed names, and he won 2 Oscars, and an afterword, an aside, is he only received his Oscar for Roman Holiday in 1993,
right,
after his death, and he only received full writing credit on everything he wrote from the Writers Guild in 2011.
Oh,
how
wow.
Absurd is that?
I did not even realize that, but it is. It's a very important story, and it's a interesting story I certainly had not really been aware of. And so I think this is the great movie for anybody who just likes old Hollywood, and it just felt like a throwback that you could kind of take yourself back to that era. There's newsreel footage, you know, Ronald Reagan in front of this committee, and, you know, everyone, though, seemed, the supporting actors to me seemed like caricatures. Like there's somebody playing John Wayne, there's somebody playing Kirk Douglas, and they felt more like impersonators of these people rather than real actors portraying them. And that was a problem I had, whereas it was fascinating to kind of think about these people who we still know, you know, are so iconic in the industry, what they were going through and what side they were supporting and who they were backing. Kirk Douglas turned out to be really the hero, I think, of this movie in terms of insisting that Trumbo eventually get credit for the movie Spartacus that he was working on. And so it was little tidbits like that that I think were the most enjoyable. But I agree, Bryan Cranston, it didn't have to be him. I could almost see like George Clooney having taken on this role as Trumbo and maybe even and probably getting nominated for it. So it's got a narrow audience, but I think those who find it who are really interested in the subject matter will have enjoyed seeing it.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you on one point.
Please.
Well, first, I want to agree with you about old Hollywood. There's Edward G. Robinson, Ronald Reagan, John Wayne, Hedda Hopper. If you don't know who she is, you will learn very well who she is. And a lot of the supporting characters who play those people I just mentioned are impersonating. They're not acting. They're impersonating. This is what I think Edward G. Robinson was like. See?
Yeah.
However, one of them was spot on and might be the best actor in the film is Louis C.K. Louis C.K., he's a comedian.
I'm going to disagree with you, but go for it.
We'll get to that. He plays Alan Hurd. Alan Hurd is probably the biggest communist in the film. He is a hardcore radical leftist, probably a full-up Stalinist, Leninist. He believes in communism, and he is very suspect of Dalton Trumbo, and Trumbo comes off as a paradox that way, and he admits it. They have a scene by the lake, and they're smoking at Trumbo's house, a very nice house with its own private lake, and he says, you know, and for what you're fighting for, no one would have their own lake, and Trumbo's like, you're right, you know, I enjoy my money, I'm a rich guy. You can fight with the purity of angels, but you know, we're only going to win through the cunning of Satan. So, you know, very writerly lines. But Trumbo was an armchair communist. He liked his money. He wrote in the bathtub with a cigarette and scotch. That's what he did.
A 1950s style lap desk.
Yeah, in the tub. The tub. Which is awesome. But he's a philosopher communist. He wasn't. I do not think a true believer like Arlen Hurd was. And Louis C.K. just did such a good job, I think, of playing Arlen Hurd. By the way, Arlen Hurd is an anagram for hardliner.
Oh,
I know. Wow. Just blew your mind right there.
Boy, yeah. I disagree with you though. I thought Louis C.K. was miscast. I felt that there were a couple of times in the movie that they should have reshot a scene that I thought he stumbled over his lines. He felt like he was stumbling over his lines to me. And so I was kind of taken out of the moment, especially the first time he shows up on the screen. I'm like, is that Louis C.K.? Like that was my first thought. And then I think I was overwatching I'm probably being a little hypercritical, but I think that's because I was so surprised to see him in that role. And I think just like almost all of this movie, any actor could have been plopped into this role. John Goodman has like his typical, it seems like he plays the same role he played in Argo, I think, in this one.
And the artist.
I mean, he just always kind of seems the same now.
But he did so good on it. Like, you really, everyone's going to laugh at John Goodman.
He nails it, but that was that's his thing. Helen Mirren is excellent as Hedda Hopper. But for the most part, I agree that you could almost throw a completely different cast into that movie and you're still going to get the same thing out of it.
Well, we're going to really big disagree on it. You're not going to bring me around on Louis C.K. I thought he was great. And also, we haven't mentioned her yet. His wife, in real life, Cleo Trumbo was very attractive. And in here, they brought in Diane Lane. And Diane Lane is extremely attractive in this movie. Cleo was younger than Dalton in real life. However, I believe Diane Lane, was underwritten. She doesn't get a lot to do. She's in a reactionary role. Like, oh, what are you doing now? I can't believe you're doing this. Right. What are you doing to our family? Let me react some more to you instead of getting my own character.
Yeah, because it seems like they're developing her character early on. And then she disappears for a while, and then she comes back. I actually thought it was Ashley Judd at first. I didn't even think it was Diane Lane. And it just was one of those roles where she's a very strong character at times, and then other times you're like, why isn't she just smacking him upside the head and setting him straight? And she sort of does, because he gets arrogant and angry, and he's obviously, there's some sort of hint at a drug problem, I think, with whatever he's taking. But it was, I think her role could have been a little stronger and better written and better fleshed out.
Yeah, I think there's a reason Trumbo only got one nomination, and that's for its really overpowering lead actor role. And out of all of the movies nominated for Best Actor, The Revenant, The Martian, and a whole bunch of, you know, whatever the others were offhand, Trumbo's the weakest.
It is, well, but if I had to choose, like, in terms of, not necessarily Best Actor, but in terms of the movies, I did like Trumbo better than The Revenant and better than Carol. So there are going to be some folks out there who I think will really enjoy seeing this movie, and it's worth seeking out if that topic and that era and Hollywood screenwriting history is of interest to you. And I think it would be absolutely a lot of fun to do a double feature of Roman Holiday and Trumbo, and I think you'd get a lot out of both.
I say, when your parents, who must be 62 or older, say, what should I go see? You tell them to go see Trumbo, and you'll be just fine.
Or if you know anyone who's just into writing.
All right, yeah, it is a good writer's film.
It's a good writer's film.
Good pull. So there are much more more movies releasing in the theaters this week. Three more, exactly. One, we just didn't see. We were both out of town. Kung Fu Panda 3. I have nothing to say to that other than it could be a panda sitting there picking his nose, and it would be better than Norm of the North.
Exactly, and it looks cute, and we predicted when we were reviewing Norm of the North, we pretty much told everybody, just wait a couple of weeks and go see Kung Fu Panda 3 instead. So my guess is that it's worth seeing if you've got kids who laugh at the trailer.
One movie that is releasing this week that nobody saw because they did not screen it for critics is 50 Shades of Black, which is a new Wayans Brothers film spoofing 50 Shades of Grey. It's kind of like if you saw their Haunted House movies or really any other, like a scary movie or scary movie 2, 3, 4, 5. 50 Shades of Black is spoofing 50 Shades of Grey. I can only assume, since they didn't screen it for critics, how amazing it must be.
How amazingly bad. I saw a tiny clip of it and it's a spoof. It's a total spoof, and I don't know who it's going to appeal to, honestly. I really don't know who might go see it.
I think it would appeal to me. I would love to go see it.
But you have to see. I don't think the spoof works if you don't see the original. So I think you have to actually have seen 50 Shades of Grey to understand and appreciate the spoof of 50 Shades of Black.
Everybody saw 50 Shades of Grey. It made like $1 billion.
Well, did you see it?
Heck yeah.
Okay. So maybe you'd enjoy the spoof. But I don't know. I think when it opens cold like that, they pretty much know that they want to get people that first weekend who don't have to worry about word of mouth. And then they'll wait and see how the next in the trilogy does. And we might see a second 50 Shades of Black if the second 50 Shades of Grey does well.
The second movie opening cold this week is surprising, but it comes with an infamous backstory of production problems. Directors quit, just didn't show up to work. It's called Jane Got a Gun, and it is a passion project from Natalie Portman. Portman's the producer and the lead actress, and she just could not get this movie made. And apparently, everyone knows why now. It's really bad. Harvey Weinstein finally picked it up. Because the distribution company that originally bought it, Relativity, went bankrupt. So he's sneaking this out in about 1,000 theaters this weekend. No marketing, no screenings, and everyone who accidentally has seen it now is saying it's awful. And it's Natalie Portman, Ewan McGregor, Joel Edgerton, and apparently it is a turkey.
That's a shame, because it is a great-sounding cast. But yeah, I'd heard absolutely nothing about that movie. When you mentioned that it was going to be opening, I was like, what is that? And so when that happens, I don't rush out to try and find it. That's one where I go, you know what? There's probably a really good reason it wasn't screened, and therefore it saved me an extra night of going out in the blizzard.
And that's a shame, because you don't really see Natalie Portman very much anymore. You saw her in Black Swan. She won her Oscar. And I know I've seen her since, but maybe once. And she comes now out with Jane Got a Gun, and
she just had a kid though, didn't she?
Well, years ago. It's not a newborn. Hey, you know
she's
what?
She's busy.
Walk
Come
it off.
On.
Well, her, I got to work.
Cut her some slack.
My wife gave birth. She goes to work. Go to work, Natalie. Go to work.
Harsh.
Okay, but since we only really saw one movie that is opening wide this week, there is a new movie that you wanted to point out that is brand new on DVD. You can get it on iTunes, Redbox, out this week. Hannah, what is that movie?
That movie is Burnt. It came and went very quickly. It was with Bradley Cooper playing this temperamental chef, sort of a Gordon Ramsay type. And I didn't highly recommend it at the time, and I still wouldn't have recommended that people rush out to the theater to see it. But I think it's one of those ones that as a rental or streaming movie, you plan a nice little dinner and a movie combination and you watch it at home. And if you are a foodie and if you like Bradley Cooper, those two things are a big part of this movie. It's a little bit of a love story. It's a redemption story. He plays this chef named Adam who is trying to come back from addictions to booze and women and all kinds of things. And his goal is to become a 3-star Michelin chef at a restaurant in London. And he's trying to sort of get some of his old crew together, and there's some new people. And it's really about his attempt to sort of overcome the fact that he's really an asshole. And people hate him personally, but respect his culinary skills. And it's a redemption movie. And no matter what, Bradley Cooper's just very easy to watch. And so he is worth seeing on the screen if you're a Bradley Cooper fan.
Now, I did not have the pleasure of screening Burnt, but can you compare it to maybe to the two most recent foodie movies I can think of that I saw are Chef and The 100-Foot Journey? Can you compare it, rack and stack it with those?
I still have never seen Chef. It is one of those ones that I've meant to see but didn't. That's a Jon Favreau one, so I'm sure it's a bit more of a comedic turn. The 100-Foot Journey, was it 100 or 1,000? I can't remember.
Just 100. You're
just, just 100 just feet across the street. So The 100-Foot Journey, I totally enjoyed. And I thought that was also just a nice foodie movie. I would probably put that slightly ahead of Burnt in terms of the full package, but they're pretty close. And both of those I consider to be just solid rentals for a dinner and a movie option.
Well, while we were snowbound through the East Coast snowstorm this weekend, I watched about 5 or 6, catch-up films. And I won't go into all of them or tell you how awful or amazing they were, but I do want to point out that I got to see the live-action and animated shorts that are nominated for Oscars this year. Those of you in major cities who can find them at your local art house theaters, they're opening this week. in a couple hundred theaters. And first off, the live-action films are really stark. There's five of them. About three and a half of them are just really hard to watch. They are gut-wrenching. My favorite one, and I think the one that's in line for the Oscar, is called Shock. It's from Kosovo. It's Kosovo's first ever Oscar nomination. Shock means friend. It takes place in 1998 in a Kosovar village dominated by invading Serb military forces. And it will shatter your soul. It is so bleak.
Is that a good thing?
I loved it.
I can be pretty darn sure that I will absolutely hate it.
My wife couldn't believe that. Like, what did you just make me sit through?
I'm with Kate on this one, yeah.
Another one that springs to mind is from Germany. It's about a father who, he's a weekend dad. So he drops by his old house, picks up his daughter. They go to the festival. They do some stuff. And it's all leading up to he's going to steal her away and go to the Philippines. And what I had wished was I wish they had done it from the point of view of the daughter, because I caught on really early to what this guy was doing. They go to the passport office. He buys her some toys to distract her. They go to a hotel, wait for the flight. And, oh, man, if it was from her point of view and you didn't really know what was going on till the end, that would have clinched it for me. I think those are the strongest ones. There is a comedy, though, and of all places, it takes place in Israeli-occupied West Bank. A very Orthodox, observant Jewish family is traveling along an Arab road going back to their settlement. They crash into a Catholic nun monastery, decapitating the Virgin Mary, and their attempts to get back home become really comedic. Shabbat starts, so he can't dial a phone, and the nuns have a vow of silence, so they can't tell him things. It's a satire, obviously, of religion, but it's quite funny.
Okay, maybe I'll look for that,
one. That was a good one. It's called Ave Maria. It bats lead off, so if you screen it back to back, it's the first one.
Oh, perfect.
And then is Shock, and then the German one.
And how long are each of these little gems?
I think Ave Maria is probably the quickest one, 15 minutes. Shock is, and the rest is probably about 20 minutes or so.
Wow.
But a much lighter fare is the animated ones, and they're usually lighter. Actually, but there's one, though, that when they screen it last. It's called Prologue. They send the kids out because it's violent, and it's a reimagining. It's very quick. It's like 7-minute reimagining of Athens versus Sparta. So you can imagine that could kind of get bloody.
It's a little bit of a downer.
And it's also my least favorite one. I don't even want to talk about it. It's so silly. My favorite one is called Bear Story. It's not the most popular one. The most popular one's from Pixar. Everyone probably already saw it if they saw The Good Dinosaur. That one's about superheroes and an immigrant family, an Indian father trying to teach his assimilated son respect for the Hindu gods, and he would just rather play with superheroes. That one's funny. I liked it, but I would vote for Bear Story, which is out of Chile, Argentina area. The circus shows up at an apartment block, and they steal the bear, the papa bear, from his bear family. They steal the giraffe from the giraffe family and take him off, and they force him to perform in the circus. And the story is, you know, he gets back home, and it's a really heartwarming story. I liked it. And only later do you realize it's about the 70s and the 80s Pinochet government when you read into it.
Okay.
I thought that was a very good one. There's another one about astronauts in training. And they're best friends all their lives, and they're training to become astronauts. And it's really funny until the end when something happens. But then it's still
the 30th really anniversary of the Challenger this weekend. I don't know if I'd want to see anything that might not be.
It's nothing. It's kind of like that, but there's a twist ending that kind of puts it back together.
Okay.
And finally, a lot of one. If people aren't voting for the Pixar one, they'll probably vote for this one. It's called The World of Tomorrow. A three-year-old picks up the phone, and it's herself calling from like hundreds of years in the future, and she's telling her what the future is like, and the three-year-old's just not comprehending. She's like, oh, that sounds pretty. Here, look at my finger, you know, and she's just, well, now we have encoded memories, and we clone ourselves, and it's showing us what, you know, a good probability of what the future is going to be like, and it's really well done. I think that's the longest one, too, but if you go see the animated shorts, watch out for Bear Story. And if you go to the live shorts, drink a beer, maybe two, settle in for some realism, big time.
I think the only good thing about the shorts is knowing that they're short. So you can sort of get through some that you wouldn't otherwise. You know me, if I don't like a movie, I turn it off after 20 minutes.
I do know so, that. Yeah.
If I'm watching it at home. So if it's at least this way, there's a possibility I'd get through it.
You know, there was one of the, it was the fourth short. It's called Stutterer. It's not bleak, and you don't want to kill yourself after watching it. It's actually a romance. An online romance where him and this girl are finally going to meet in person, and he's so nervous because he goes online because he stutters. He has an awful stutter, and he can't speak very well. So it's about him leading up to going to meet this girl.
Oh.
And Kate loved it.
Okay.
Because it's so sappy and cute.
Oh, sounds just perfect. I'll look that one up. Yep, absolutely.
So if you get a chance this weekend, folks, and you're not, you know, trying to catch up on something like Spotlight, or The Revenant that you didn't see.
The Revenant?
Well, you got to see The Revenant. Everybody's seen The Revenant.
If they haven't seen The Martian yet, they'd better not be going to see The Revenant.
All right, don't miss The Martian. Whatever. But always take a chance. Cause they're in theaters always a couple weeks a year, 2-3 weeks, to see the short films. It's so rare you really get to see quality short film, and I love that the Academy takes the time to package these up into really their own movies to give us a chance to see them. So, to wrap up, we discussed Disney's The Finest Hours. I say skip it. Too many dudes at sea movies, and you don't need to listen to these Boston accents.
I say it's okay, but yeah, I wouldn't rush out to see it either.
We caught up on Trumbo because everyone's talking about it for Bryan Cranston, nominated for Best Actor. I say if you've seen the other four movies nominated for Best Actor, then you can see this one. This one should be 5 out of 5 on your list for that.
And anyone who's into Hollywood, old Hollywood in writing would get something out of this movie. But again, I'd see Roman Holiday before I'd see this one.
Oh, by all means, good pull. Roman Holiday.
Yeah.
We didn't see Kung Fu Panda 3. Nobody saw 50 Shades of Black. And nobody saw Jane Got a Gun. So let us know if you saw them. I'd be interested to hear your opinion.
Absolutely.
Hannah, you told us about Burnt.
Yep. It's a back burner movie, but hey, if you've got nothing else to do, I say check it out.
Love the puns tonight. I think that's two for you. I told you about the short films. Take your pick, live action versus animated. If you're into real cinema, go see the live action. If you can't take certain things, go see the animated ones. You'll be fine either way. You'll be in for a good time.
And then you'll seem really smart when the Oscars are announced, if you've actually seen it.
Like, have you? Let me tell you about Shock.
That's right.
The Albanian Kosovar.
If you really want to impress your friends, you'll actually have a pick for the Oscar pool for Best Short.
Preview for next week. Nicholas Sparks, The Choice.
North Carolina, military, love story, death, miscommunication, and happy ending. I'm predicting that those will all be in that movie.
I'm predicting I'm gonna go in with an open mind. That's what I'm predicting.
I'm predicting I'm going to see you squirming throughout this movie, and that I will probably think it was typical Nicholas Sparks movie, and that anybody who's seen all the other Nicholas Sparks movies is, you know, they're gonna go see this one too.
But I'm really excited about next week is the new Coen Brothers movie, Hail Caesar, starring George Clooney. Yay, Coen Brothers. Hit me again.
I'm hit or miss with the Coen brothers, but I certainly have high hopes for... I enjoyed Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? So I think the Coen brothers, George Clooney combo gives it a little more of a mainstream angle.
Come on. I think the last one was Inside Llewyn Davis. Didn't you like Inside Llewyn Davis?
No, but the George Clooney combo.
Oh.
I'm talking the combo of the Coen brothers and George Clooney. That's what draws me in.
Scarlett Johansson's in it. She was in Coen brothers, The Man Who Wasn't There.
I don't like that most of the Coen brother movies.
Come on.
So I'm going to really try very hard.
How do you not like most? What do you mean you don't like most of the... Barton Fink, Miller's Crossing, Blood Simple, No Country for Old Men, Best Picture winner, The Man Who Wasn't There, The Big Lebowski, Fargo.
Yeah, we'll see.
Raising Arizona. Nicolas Cage in Raising Arizona.
I did like Nicolas Cage in Raising Arizona, but that was very quirky, and so that's just it. You have to really be into the quirky movie for the Coen brothers to resonate. To me, the Coen brothers are like Woody Allen. You either like Woody Allen movies or a certain number of them, or you don't. And Coen Brothers is that way for me, where I like some of them okay, but I'm not an automatic fan.
AKA, you either have taste or you don't. All right. Well, Anna, thanks again.
Obviously, my brain is not firing. I do not have a good comeback for that. But I'll get my revenge when you're sitting through the Nicholas Sparks movie.
Hey, we clash on our cinema clash. And oh my God, you are going to get revenge on Nicholas. I mean, I'm going in with an open mind. And it has a very good chance of being amazing.
I think the fact that you say you're going in with an open mind is total bullshit, but that's okay.
All right, Hannah, on behalf of myself, Charlie Jewell, Hannah Buchdahl, thanks for coming again. Chickflix.net, check it out.
Thank you.
All right, see you next week, folks.
Take care.